This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about COVID-19 and business interruption insurance. Now, this is part two of this podcast, so please do go and listen to our part one. I am joined by barrister Mr. Sailesh Mehta from Red Lion Chambers in London. Sailesh is a senior barrister who prosecutes and defends in high-profile, complex and law-defining cases, and he regularly advises government agencies at a national level. Sailesh also lectures other lawyers and judges on aspects of law, both in the UK and abroad, and he is a founding member of the Bar Human Rights Committee. Thank you so much for joining me, Sailesh.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And yes, so part two of business interruption insurance. And I have to say, we only recorded part one last week, and it does already seem like there has been progress on this subject. So just to put our listeners in a little bit of, give them a bit of background. So on the 15th of September, there was a test case in the High Court relating to business interruption insurance, and we discussed a lot of that in part one. And this all stems from the fact that most insurance policies, even though they do have business interruption cover, are refusing to pay out businesses for a loss of earnings, loss of income as a result of the government lockdown, as a result of a loss of income because of the pandemic. So it's the FCA has taken it upon themselves to take the matter to the High Court in London on behalf of businesses to be able to try and fight the corner of business owners and say, look, you know, these policies need to pay out. And obviously the insurers on the other side are fighting their corner and probably very concerned that if they do start paying out, this is going to snowball. So there was that test case on the 15th of September. That was the first hearing. And we've just been told and informed of a second hearing that took place on the 2nd of October in the High Court. And there's been progress there. Before we come on to that progress, Sailesh, can we just pick up from where we left off in part one of our podcast? Because we were looking at what the court concluded on the key types of business interruption cover. And we started discussing this at the end of episode one. Can we just recap on that first point and then continue with the points that we were looking at, please, on that?
So just by way of background, businesses have insurance to pay them for when there are things that go wrong through no fault of their own. And therefore, businesses pay insurance companies on a regular basis, on a yearly basis, to cover for these calamities. One of these calamities that they cover themselves for is business interruption. The usual business interruption policy is if there's a fire, or if there's an infestation, or if there's damage of an airplane,
or a flood, or something has happened that's prevented you from opening your doors to conduct your business.
And usually, therefore, it's some damage-related problem. But some insurance policies go beyond damage and therefore cover the policyholder for other potential problems. One of those potential problems is something like a disease, something like a pandemic.
And infectious diseases, actually, I've seen that in some policies where they say infectious diseases.
Exactly. And so this is what the test case was about. The Financial Conduct Authority, which is responsible in law for regulating insurance businesses and insurance companies, decided on behalf of policyholders to take this test case. Because with businesses desperate for money, getting no income, of course, they were looking to their insurers to pay out on these clauses. The insurance companies were saying, no, and sometimes for good reason, that there are good reasons why the policy does not cover you.
And I think it's really interesting, actually, Salish, to mention that it's the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, are the ones that's actually taking the insurers to court on behalf of businesses. And that's quite, actually, if you think about that, it's quite a powerful thing, because it's a governing body that governs that industry, that governs the insurance industry, saying, hold on a moment, we need to clear this up and we need to get it absolutely right for the business owners, rather than actually, in my mind, I would have thought, well, they may want to protect the insurers. They may want to protect the industry that they regulate. But actually here, they're saying, no, we need to protect the industry that we regulate, that provides the service.
Absolutely. It is part of their statutory duty to make sure that they regulate the insurance industry, and in a way that protects the customer. In this case, the customer is the policyholder. And of course, in a practical way, it made sense for one body rather than thousands of individual policyholders to take the test case. And so a number of insurance companies joined in that test case, and the court was dealing with a range of clauses that were the problem, or the potential problem. So there were about 20 to 30 lead clauses that the court was dealing with. So it was a long judgment, 150 pages long. The litigation started in June, there were hearings in July, and the judgment came out in September. So very, very fast when it comes to a case of this size.
Yes.
And most of the decision, most of the judgment was in fact seen to be in favour of policyholders. The insurance companies had a number of very straightforward but some very complicated arguments as to why particular clauses in particular circumstances shouldn't apply. And by and large, the court said no. For a majority of these clauses, the judgment was in favour of the policyholders. So it was good news for the 300,000 to 400,000 policies.
That's a lot. That's a lot. I mean, you know, it's very trying times for everybody and for the insurers. I'm not sort of trying to discount that at all. But naturally, and I said this in our part one podcast, you know, people that have business insurance, and when you think, oh, I've got business interruption insurance, that's going to tide me over. You go to claim and some interpretation of your policy on that point means you're not covered. There's a lot of businesses out there who are really desperate for this help from the insurers. So let's talk about the points that we were saying are covered.
So of course, it's difficult to go through all of the minutiae of the point, but broadly, the court was dealing with causation. And so is there a connection between the loss of business that a business has and COVID-19?
Oh, absolutely.
You think so. And of course, the answer is absolutely. But the problem is that what the clause says that binds contractually that the policyholder and insurance company. So by way of example, one predominant set of clauses the court dealt with is the clause says, if there is interruption to your business because you're not allowed access to your business by a government body or a local authority within a 25-mile range, then a number of things follow, including possible payout. And so the question arises, well, only 25-mile range. And so how does one decide if your 25-mile range is covered? Because, of course, the government said the whole country is covered in some instances for some businesses. And therefore, do you, the policyholder, have to prove if you've got a shop that in your 25-mile radius there was someone with COVID-19? So that's an important question, because, of course, the insurance companies were suggesting that you do, that you need that level of specificity within the 25-mile radius, otherwise you're not covered.
Even though the government said you must close your business, you must not be open for business.
Yes. So as far as the government in mandating the closure, then of course there is no question about it. Although I should say, even in relation to that point, there were some businesses that were required to be closed, such as restaurants with sitting down diners. But there were some businesses, for example, accountancy firms or lawyers' businesses, that weren't required to close. And then you've got the more difficult question. If you've got a restaurant business with a takeaway, takeaways weren't required to close. And so you can imagine, you can understand the layers of complexity. If you run a lawyer's business or an accountancy firm, and because of lockdown, none of your clients are coming to you, is your insurance policy, is the clause covering you? And the answer is no in that situation, because you were not required to close.
Yeah, well, this is it. This is it. This is the thing. You know, reality, I have to say, for me, reality and how the law delivers itself sometimes does feel really, really far apart. Because, you know, like you say, there's going to be huge issues, I think, with those businesses where they were not required to close. They had to close maybe because the staff said, very sorry, but I'm not going to risk my life coming to work and being in that environment and possibly catching COVID on the way into work or from a colleague or anything, something like that. And then there's the whole impact of loss of business as a result of the pandemic, rather than you having to have actually put the lock on the front door.
Well, in terms of interpretation, I'm afraid the court was quite tough and quite narrow in interpretation of clauses such as that. So the court, in my view, rightly said, unless you are required by the law to close your business, you cannot, the clause in your insurance policy isn't even triggered, because the parties who negotiated, the policyholder insurance company, part of the negotiation in the clause was you have to be required to be closed. And if you're not required to be closed, then tough luck, the clause doesn't apply. So to that extent, the court interpreted the clauses in the proper, conservative, old-fashioned insurance law way. But on a broader basis, the court interpreted these clauses in a way that assisted policyholders. So to give you another example that you might think is in La La Land, the insurance companies were saying, and this is something called trend clauses. So the insurance companies were saying, given that the clause that applies is only within 25 miles, even if you, the policyholder, can show that there is someone within your 25 miles that's caught COVID and therefore the clause triggers, the fact is, because the rest of the country is closed down, you would never have got the business. So 99% of your business would have closed down anyway, and that no customers would have come to your shop. And therefore, the trend, and that hence the trend clause, is beyond your 25 miles, you're not going to get anything anywhere. And therefore, off your £1 million claim, you'd only have a reduction of about 1% in your 25-mile radius.
You cannot blame, honest to God, Joe Public for thinking some of this stuff is just so... I mean, you mentioned La La Land. La La Land, crazy, unfair, unrealistic, not in touch with what actually goes on. And, you know, I mean, look, the average insurance policy, and it doesn't matter whether you're insuring a mobile phone or your multi-million pound business or your home business or whatever, it goes on for pages and pages. And the writing just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So you have to have the perfect eyesight for a start to be able to even read the stuff. But this is the thing, Salish, you know, obviously we're talking about what's going on in court that's hopefully going to eventually assist businesses. But some of this stuff, you just can't help but think, really? Really, is it the case that the insurer can say, well, you were never going to get that business anyway, because perhaps you were based in a shopping centre where there was no foot flow. The shopping centre was going to be closed, but you could have been open all day long. But, you know, the impact, the ultimate impact on businesses of the insurers not paying out, and now businesses having to wait for the courts to decide whether there will be payouts on business interruption insurance, and not all business interruption insurance, but perhaps some of the policies. You're talking about a third of businesses have had to close and are closing down or are being financially restructured, those that can, in some way. This is a big, big, big thing.
Absolutely. There are two major factors at work when it comes to the insurance company's attitude. The first is historical. The insurance law is one of the oldest and most developed areas of law.
And I'm sure.
Every time there's a major case that acts against an insurance company, they will all universally change their policy to close that new gap that the law has created. And so imagine that happening over 100 years. And so you can imagine, as a result of that, that the clauses are tightly drafted, taking account of all of the previous case law that opens up an insurance company. That's the historical nature of the beast that the court and the policyholder deals with. And of course, the second aspect is no one expects, even the bean counters and insurance companies who number crunch, no one expects a pandemic. And therefore, when a pandemic does happen and when businesses close, of course, the likely claims are going to be in the billions of pounds, not just in this country, but all over the world. And therefore, insurance companies, or some of them at least, are facing an existential crisis.
Well, I was just going to say, will the insurance companies have to pay out the billions of pounds if the result and the judgment goes in the favour of the business owners? They will, won't they, really?
In principle, they will. So if on appeal the judgment goes against insurance companies, a lot of them are going to have to pay fairly large amounts. Some of them will claim that they're going to go under. I suspect what happens in many industries when there's a sudden decline in the economy may well occur here, in that the insurance companies will probably go to the Chancellor of the Exchequer and say, do you really want a country in which five of the top insurance companies go under, causing massive problems for competition and individuals? Do you not want to support the insurance industry and bail us out? That is what is likely to happen.
Wow, big stuff. I mean, let's talk about the hearing that just took place on the 2nd of October, if we can, Sailesh, in the High Court again, because that was quite a positive outcome. And I think I say the word positive outcome because of the way the court has said, right, this is urgent. This needs to be get dealt with. We haven't got time to sit there and hear this in the way that we normally would. What's happened at that hearing?
So ordinarily, given that the High Court has ruled and given a judgment, a detailed judgment, one or both parties would then consider an appeal and be to the Court of Appeal. But there are ways of leapfrogging the Court of Appeal and going straight to the Supreme Court. This is deemed the sort of case of such great public importance that it was likely that the High Court would say yes to the leapfrogging. And in fact, that's exactly what the High Court said. And so the case is now going to go to the Supreme Court. There's no date that I'm aware of for the hearing, but I imagine that would be fast-tracked. Both the claimant as well as the respondents have said that they want it fast-tracked. And so I imagine within the next few weeks there will be a hearing in the Supreme Court.
No, and I think that's just, you know, great to hear, I have to say that, because one of the things that does come with the legal process is the timely, never let alone the costly, but the time it takes to hear anything in court, the time it takes to get, you know, a court date for a hearing. And this is a huge, huge case that's going to really set the ground for a lot of things. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's in the public interest that the decisions are made on this. And well done to the High Court, you know, for making that decision to really fast track it. And as you said, leapfrog it into the Supreme Court so that this can conclude, and then, you know, insurers will know what they're doing, business owners will know what they're doing. It's going to make a massive impact for both sides on a huge magnitude scale. So let's tell our listeners, what's your advice to those who have business insurance? Can they check if they're covered themselves? Should they run off and instruct a lawyer? And in what circumstances at the moment, Sailesh?
So the starting point is that we don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do, in judgment. And so a cautious bystander would say, let's wait until the Supreme Court rules. So that's the starting point, because then at least we'll know what the definitive answer is.
As to whether the business interruption insurance will have to pay out or not pay out. That's the global, what we're saying, decisions that need to come out. And also on what basis, I'm sure, if the High Court hearing on the 15th of September was 150 pages long in terms of the judgment, then I should imagine that the judgment coming out of the Supreme Court is going to be some pages long. But, you know, the advisors, the legal advisors and everybody else involved, the insurance brokers, will know the headlines of that judgment and be able to hopefully advise you quite quickly.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean that a business should just sit back and wait, because this is a time in which the business should be looking at its own policy, making sure that the business understands the policy so that when the Supreme Court judgment comes out, they know exactly what part of the policy to look at and what part of the Supreme Court judgment affects their policy. So this is the time, in fact, to utilise by getting your policy out. There is no harm in doing a bit of research, in reading the High Court case. Unfortunately, while most judgments these days are designed for the ordinary person to understand, having read the judgment, how it affects them, I'm afraid this is an area where even lawyers are going to have difficulty understanding. I've had to read the judgment twice, and even then I can't be certain if I had to sit an exam.
That's very honest of you, Salish, but no. Look, I mean, you know, in terms of making the law accessible, when judgments of this magnitude come out, they are so legally, technically worded. I just think, you know, take your time, do your research, get advice, especially for something like this. You know, it just has to go without saying, because you could miss a point in your policy that actually does cover you, that does mean that you have cover.
And this is one of those rare situations where I think actually getting advice, professional advice at an early stage is well worth it. And by professional advice, of course, there's a range here. You can go to your accountant who does your accounts, or you can go to insurance brokers. But even accountants and insurance brokers, I don't think, are completely equipped to look at the judgment and understand it. And so this is an area where, in fact, lawyers really should be contacted, particularly if you've got a potential claim or that's going to be quite large. Because what you don't want is either to miss a large claim because you're...
Or any claim, you know, because, you know, as at times like this, you know, every pound, penny, everything totally counts, and you just don't want to miss any claim. And, you know, my worry is you go to, for example, a high street lawyer, a high street solicitor, and even they miss something because it can, you know, this is quite a complex area. So, you know, do double up on the advice, I would say, just to make sure. So the insurance broker, if you've gone through an insurance broker, which is likely for business insurance, a lawyer, independent legal advice, just be absolutely sure of what you've got, what it means for you, because this is big business.
And businesses can start preparing. If their initial view is, yes, the clause may well cover them, there's no harm in the interim, while waiting for Supreme Court judgment, to start assessing your losses. So check the clause, because some insurance policies have a limit, have a ceiling on how much you can claim. Others don't. So check with your accountants, check with your business records what your loss is, so that you can hit the ground running. If you do decide that you're going to pursue the insurance company.
No, absolutely. I think that's sound advice. But what I think that also does is tie you into part three, Salish. Surely.
Your short 15-minute session.
Once the Supreme Court has made its decision or had a significant hearing, I don't know whether there'll be one, two or how many. I shouldn't imagine this will be going on for a very long time.
What's likely is that there will be a compendious judgment from the Supreme Court that will cover similar ground to the High Court decision, so it will cover the main standard clauses. Then, of course, there are bound to be some nitty-gritty litigation on specific parts, specific clauses that haven't been precisely dealt with by the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court can't possibly deal with every permutation combination of policy. So there will still be a series of smaller cases that will spin off from the Supreme Court. But the hope is that the majority of policy clauses will be decided upon. And then the FCA will probably intervene again, to this extent that it will give advice to the insurance company that it will expect to be followed. And the advice will be based on the FCA's understanding of the Supreme Court judgment.
Along with, I'm sure, deadlines and dates and things like that, because in these sorts of situations, time is of crucial essence, which is why we were saying earlier, you know, the High Court said, no, let's not do this through the court structure and system that we processes that we normally would. Let's just ping this up into the highest court of the land and have it dealt with there. Good. So part three is agreed then. Fabulous. Salish, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate our chat today.
My pleasure.
And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.